Thank you again, everyone, for being here. It looks like I am standing between you and lunchtime, in a sense, so this is going to be really quick. And I will try to accommodate those who have visual impairment in regards to the slides. So for this presentation, what I will be discussing really would be the work that I completed with the Johannesburg Society of the Blind in Johannesburg, South Africa, where we were trying to get a good sense of what really are the baseline information, the challenges that people who have visual impairment and also physically disabled experience in regards to getting access to healthcare services. This study was actually funded through the Secure the Future initiative of the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation platform. And I myself am a paid employee of Rutgers University, but also a public health resident that was funded through the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation. Tappy Wong, my colleague, is with the Johannesburg Society of the Blind, and he's a paid employee, and Dean Barone is a paid employee of Rutgers University School of Pharmacy as well. The purpose of this study, again, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, is just really to get an understanding of what are the challenges that people with visual impairment and physically disabled experience in regards to accessing health care. As you can see here, the aims of our study we try to focus on is how do we begin to identify what modalities that disabled patients in South Africa utilize to obtain health information, what barriers of uptake of services of people living with visual impairment and disabilities, and then to begin to, as a public health pharmacist, what quality of the pharmaceutical counseling do these individuals actually experience in regards to understanding their medication utilization and intake. Johannesburg Society of the Blind was founded in 1926, and their vision really is to assist the blind to walk unafraid. And they provide a number of outreach programs that really cater to their set of population. If you think about the intervention programs that we have for the sighted, they also felt the need that the non-sighted individuals need the same type of interventions that really address gender-based violence, HIV/AIDS integration, as well as education and resources for independent living for those who are physically and visually impaired and disabled. The foundation, the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation affiliation with this organization stems from a program we supported last year with HIV/AIDS Seeks No Disability. And this program actually focused on really doing an outreach visit on providing peer-to-peer support, education, and integration of patients who are positive, and also tries to reduce the stigma of those who are positive but do not feel very comfortable disclosing that information, but also providing additional services and education for these individuals. So when you think about our exploratory study, this really focused on South Africa. So again, there's limited understanding of the disability, the actual issues that really pertain to the population of those living with disabilities, which of course includes visual impairment. They're often excluded from the mainstream of society and thus are prevented from accessing fundamental social, political, and economic rights. So I performed an 85-item questionnaire conducted via face-to-face interviews. Of course, I did have a translator because South Africa has 13 standard type of official languages, and many of my participants range from the age of 18 to 60, and we focus really in Johannesburg, Durban, Ladysmith, and Estcourt, just because these are also services that the Johannesburg Society of the Blind also provide within that network area. We had 40 participants that participated in this survey. 15 of them were male, and 25 of them were females. And the age range from 18 to 29, 9 of them, then 30 to 49 was 24, and 6 of them ranged from the age of 50 to 64. Most of my respondents had visual impairment, a lot more than those who were physically disabled, and the most common language spoken among my respondents were Zulus. And that was a common language. Of course, Xhosa, the Pedi, the Sotus, the Swana, there were only two. Four of them understood English, and there was one that spoke Sanga, But I've always thought that Zulu was very hard for me to understand just a little bit more, and I thought Swanas were more sexy than the other languages. But you couldn't tell them that because the Zulus, of course, are very happy and proud about their language. The highest level of education among them really is grade levels 8 to 12. So you have about 47% of them that really receive a level of education of 8 to 12 there. And then there's a technical degree. Now, the technical degree is somewhat similar to an associate degree. And in some ways, it can be more of a trade certification type of program, not necessarily a degree, but it's just giving them the certification that they can actually participate in the job employment. Three of them actually have a bachelor's degree, and then one of the things I just wanted to highlight is majority of them came from the Johannesburg Society network. So when we go into the results of the actual study itself, one of the questions we asked many individuals in terms of where do you prefer to receive your information regarding health education? And it's surprising for me, I thought that they would rather want to, as a healthcare professional, they would really go to medical professionals for health education. But 36% of the respondents really rely on community groups for health education. And then 24% of them relied on radio. They prefer to actually go to the radio shows and radio as their main source of health education regarding their different disease states. We only ranked 14%, and I guess I thought that was a little scary just because most medical professionals really understand the disease patho and they understand the different medications. But as you can see here, a lot of the respondents that were a part of this network felt more comfortable with the community groups at the actual clinics or within their villages or within their communities regarding how do you understand being HIV positive, how do you understand your disorder, how do you understand the fact that I'm not very clear on what type of disease I have, but maybe you can tell me from your own personal experience what you've experienced that would help me understand if I'm being treated appropriately or if it's something I should even be alarmed about regarding my actual situation. Another question that we asked here, again, it's 85, and I'm just picking out the pieces of here that was interesting because when the question was asked regarding what is your preferred delivery of medical information, 19 of the respondents really prefer audio and video, and this is also just to support the first question that was asked in regards to them preferring the radio as their source of information and education. But if you look at Braille, I thought one of the issues or one of the concerns they would prefer is actually having materials made in Braille. A lot of my respondents that were part of this study, actually, not a lot of them were actually born blind, or many of them became blind over the years because of a health condition that caused them to be blind. So many, again, of them are like at the age of 25, they lost their sight. Understanding Braille is a very difficult language for anyone who's not familiar with Braille to begin to integrate, especially if there aren't any schools or any type of programs that actually provide that services for people who have just recently become blind. So for them, they really do prefer having audio and video information as a preferred format for medical information versus having materials developed in Braille. Now, the Department of Disabilities have created materials for Braille, but what they're finding that is even though as they create materials, you can create it, people will not utilize them as how you would expect them to do them because, again, there's a lack of understanding and education that needs to be provided to the people who actually need to understand Braille to begin to read Braille materials in Braille. And as Amy highlighted already in her presentation, the top three issues that we saw here that were barriers that hindered access to healthcare was transportation, lack of transportation, trouble with stigma, and for us in South Africa, hospital staff attitude played a major role in regards to getting access to care. So we have an issue, of course, where transportation is a big issue. But then many people, I thought it was scary to see that maybe our issue may not necessarily be the healthcare, it may not be the transportation or the system or the infrastructure, but many of the healthcare personnel themselves and their behavior and the way they treat people with disabilities really hinders one's need to really access care because of the way they're being treated in the hospital system. other sources that they prefer to get understanding of medication, which I felt very comfortable and happy to see this result, because as a pharmacist myself, I am always concerned about how do you really know how to take your medication, especially if you're not sighted. How do you begin to distinguish between the different medication, and as well as understanding how do you determine which is an expired or a counterfeit drug for an individual who is not able to distinguish the two. A lot of them prefer, 74% of them prefer to get their medication understanding from the health clinics and a corner house clinic. Now, with my population, many of them are receiving their medications from the clinic, and I thought it was very interesting to see that not that if you ask them the question, are you positive or do you have a health condition you'd like to disclose, that many of them would still check off no. But again, there's understanding, and what I've seen already is that they're getting that medication from the clinic because they are positive. But that comfort zone of being comfortable with disclosing your status is a big issue for people that we see in sighted, but also even in the non-sighted population. So as I get to the result finding, we found that many of the respondents were very comfortable with radio, 24%, and community groups as a preferred source of health-related information, while 55% of my respondents were very frustrated receiving information in an inaccessible format, which is, of course, can be verified through the actual places of information and education they like to receive the information. Hospital staff served as a number one, I felt, as a major barrier regarding getting access to information and support, and a lot of my participants felt that they were treated for unfairly due to their disability and their inability to visually see the actual care they're receiving. Please forgive me. But throughout my whole conversations, it was very interesting to see that there was a strong perception that their intelligence, of course, was undermined, but the social aspects of disability negatively impacted their independent living and limited their options of employment, of care, and resources that can be utilized by them. There were limitations to the study, which I have here, and I'm just due to time, I really wanted to highlight the fact that it was an 85-item questionnaire that I felt was not as structured as I needed to have it structured, where it should have been maybe a minimum of 30, maximum of 30, really. And I had a translator, so it was very hard for me to really understand what information was really teased out, especially being that my translator really knew Zulu and the other two languages that we saw that were higher, except for the smaller groups. So that was something I thought was limitations. And in conclusion, pretty much I do have the slides uploaded online, but what we hope to do is really share our findings with the Gauteng provincial government so that way they can begin to incorporate some of the challenges we've seen with this population into their policy and their research in terms of changing the infrastructure and also raising their awareness of the vulnerabilities that this group of people actually really experience. Because if we are not very conscious of their issues and their concerns, then we can overlook a bigger issue where their health needs may be overlooked and that become a bigger burden for the country itself. I am a healthcare consultant. Again, Tappy Wells information is online, as well as Vanga Sili, who is the CEO of the Johannesburg Society of the Blind. And I want to thank you for sitting here and listening to our presentation too. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to entertain questions. Unfortunately, as APHA is making its efforts to become more accessible, it hasn't learned that you need a floating mic. this is our microphone. I would invite you, if you have a question, I'll be happy to repeat it so that the panel can answer it. What? Oh, they put it there. I'm sorry. I take it back. My apologies to APHA. I will bring around the floating mic. So if you have questions, just a minute. We didn't have one yesterday.
I was in the session the same time yesterday, and they brought it in during one of the speakers.
Oh, okay.
You know. Yeah. So. Talk at all about the additional barrier of the training
Yes, that was an issue that came up very frequently. And it came up both from consumers and staff. The consumers complained that the staff was not really able to help them often to understand how to use assistive technology once they had procured it. And we also heard from staff saying that they didn't receive the training that they needed on technology and the ability to keep up, because it's so time intensive just to keep up with what's coming up and what's new and what's available. Thank you.
What we really did look at, it was interesting. This is something that I just observed in my results. Not everyone really disclosed their status there. But what we found that there's two different programs. The HIV AIDS Seasonal Disability was a different program where they were really providing outreach, education and medication adherence and compliance with that program. My study was just looking at in terms of what challenges they really have with their medication, regardless of whether it's over-the-counter medications or chronic medication regarding either they're diabetic or positive or anything of that sort. So not focused on really the HIV AIDS population itself, but I did find that there were a number of patients that had some challenges between distinguishing the two or the three medications if they did not receive their actual treatment from a clinic. Yeah, and it's funny, I can't really give you a good number to say how many of them were associated with it, because, again, stigma is a big issue for us to determine what really is associated with the actual disease itself or versus something of a... I did find out, this is something I just remembered, there were a number of my patients that received care for glaucoma and lost their eyesight because of that. I did ask them, what do you think is the cause of your loss of your eyesight? And many of them said, oh, I went to a certain clinic and I had glaucoma, and then 2 weeks later I lost my eyesight. And so what we do want to look at to find out if it's people who went to that same clinic, could that be an issue, or is it the fact that the procedure itself was not done correctly, or maybe they didn't really need a procedure for glaucoma? And that's another reason why people need to be more informed and educated about what needs to be treated. Okay, no problem.
Hi, I'm Meg Tracy from Montana. I really appreciated the way this panel reflected the theme of this year's meeting, going from global to local. And across all the settings are the real issues that Montanans face in pursuing their health. And I just wanted to ask if the panelists could make some comments on that. I was really struck by Wyoming being so high on an access issue with only four providers, and just really wanting to highlight some of the observations from the needs assessments around transportation challenges and the geographic distribution of those providers in a pretty big state with a lot of geologic kind of barriers. But I did want to just ask whether the needs assessment data in Maine were looked at by rural versus metro areas. And also, I just wanted to mention Working Well with Disability, which is a program that CDC has invested in. It's the adoption of Living Well with Disability, but it's really a readiness program that VR helps to distribute concerns and independent living to really support people to get ready for work. So just moving folks along the continuum and through some of those barriers. So, but just some questions on that, and also the national center. How are you guys looking at the needs of rural populations and messaging and packaging resources for people? I just have to mention, you know, one
think I can address a little bit. I haven't done research, full disclosure. I haven't done a CSNA in the state of Maine. But we have looked at actually some transportation among people with disabilities and other things in Maine and elsewhere. And certainly transportation becomes a bigger and bigger issue the more rural it gets. And one of the things I've seen in many states is that they will centralize services so that, for example, a school for the blind will be in a larger metropolitan area and kids from all over will come and actually reside there at the school. And sometimes in the very rural areas, the difficulty with transportation is actually compounded by a sort of cultural closed offedness, where people often, particularly a child with blindness or a visual disability, parents don't want to send them to the big city. You know, they're scared to have them go to these centralized locations where they can get better services. So there are all kinds of problems around the rural nature of communities and how to get services out to them or how to bring them in to where the services are. Thank you for the question. I think there were other
questions too. So I thought everybody did a great job. I have a question for Lori on the data. So it's great to use the Burgess data. Going forward, that won't help. Thinking back to the providers and how they identify themselves, if there could be a better way to do that. You know, I looked at the stats, and Alabama came out to me because I was a UAB graduate. Mm-hmm. And I, as a UAB graduate, we were all trained, you know, to do this. And I'd say most of my classmates did low vision in their practice. That may not have been the main thing they did. So for some reason, I'm thinking those providers in that state are probably not thinking of themselves or identifying themselves as that. So I just wanted to get your feedback on that. If there's something that you can do different, that would be great. Thanks.
Yeah. I think your point is very well taken that we have a challenge in. Thank you. Oh, it's okay. So there's a. Thanks. There's a challenge, I think, within optometry, and we are, I think, evolving with regards to identifying areas of, quote-unquote, specialization. But right now, an optometrist is an optometrist is an optometrist. And we all receive training. Not everybody chooses to provide a particular aspect of optometric care within their practice. And those, the model that I have practiced and I'm moving away from was the full-time, 100%, I only see folks with vision impairment. And I can tell you that over the last 7 or 8 years, just within my research network, the vast majority of the folks I'm working with from the research perspective are a day a week, half a day a week. They have a much lower census of individuals with vision loss, but it's part of the continuum of care. And I'm anecdotally hoping that part of that was from efforts that we've made over the last decade from the AOA and NEI to increase awareness of how important it is to provide care beyond the medical and the surgical and the therapeutic piece, to go beyond and say, okay, now we've revved up the car engine. This is as good as the engine's going to be. Now how do we get you to operate the vehicle? And really focusing on the functional aspect of visual loss. How do we improve? The core of everything is how do we improve visual function? Everything stems from that. Once we have accurate diagnosis, once we have accurate assessment, and we understand what the full picture is, not from the retina perspective, but from the entire eye and visual system perspective, then we can accurately address the interdisciplinary needs or the multi-professional needs that the individual might benefit from and get that built into the care plan. I think we're making great strides in that regard, but to kind of go back to the beginning, part of our biggest challenge is finding out why folks are just not getting to the care. So we know there are barriers. We know there are potential access barriers. We know there are realized access barriers. But one of the key aspects of this work is helping to try and identify why folks who are newly diagnosed with vision loss are not getting that extra educational piece of there's more that can be done. So we as optometry have a role to play. Ophthalmology has a role to play. Primary care has a role to play. Everybody involved with someone who could potentially have, vision issues has, I think, a small role to play. And that's a public health issue. So thank you for bringing that up. That's my 2 cents.
Any other questions?
Education, income, employment status between sighted and visually impaired residents, and they're always lower on every scale, so there are definitely challenges with educational attainment.
Thank you.